Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
It's day four of Warren Zevon Week, and we're ready to bring you more of our admiration for this underappreciated artist.
That's right, Jim. I'm so glad to be a part of this, but I thought I just saw Patrick leaving.
Wait, what? Patrick, where are you going?
Oh, sorry, guys. My ride's here.
Okay, as we mentioned yesterday, we're deep in the wilderness years with Warren Zevon.
Yep.
We are talking about his career all week because we have with us Hunter Bennett, who is a big Warren Zevon fan.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've established that by this point. The show you're listening to is called Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us is, as I said,
Hunter Bennett.
Hey, Hunter. And we're all talking on the Zoom. We can see each other, which is nice. Mm-hmm. We can see Patrick's record collection. And from time to time, he'll pull out a record and show us something interesting about it.
Well, I'll tell you, it's interesting. On that topic, there's a certain point here where I switched to buying Warren Zevon CDs.
Yeah.
And I think it was after the Asylum year. So that's when I went all CDs. But I've got a few of the 80s and 90s on CD. And, and also a really kind of interesting compilation. I think Hunter has it as well. It's called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. That's a two CD set put out... I don't know. It covers everything. I don't know if it's on Elektra or Rhino or something like that, but it's quite an interesting overview of his entire career and has many of the songs we've talked about. So if you're looking, if you are someone who perhaps, I don't know, it seems weird to me that maybe not everybody likes Zevon as much as we do, but if you don't know his work, this is actually not a bad, you know, place to sort of dip your toe. And I don't know what you would say, Hunter, but it's not bad.
I think it's great. It's because it's got the Route 66 theme song that we just heard on the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
It's got, he also did another theme for some HBO show, or maybe it was an episode of an HBO show that I think was based on like a Stephen King short story or something like that. Hmm. It's got like cool rarities on there. It's got
Raspberry Beret. Yeah, that we talked about. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I recommend it highly. In fact, that that came out when I was really in the throes of my full-on Warren Zevon obsession.
Oh, cool.
I remember, oddly, it came out the same day as the Descendants album, Everything Sucks.
Oh, really?
I bought them both on the same day at Tower Records on South Street in Philadelphia.
Nice.
But yeah, and that Zevon compilation also has a nice photo book with funny liner notes.
It really does, yeah. And it goes into a little bit about each song. You know, it's got some lyrics in here too, which is great.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you are one of those people, I mean, to me, it's almost like, well, you've never heard Lennon and McCartney? Of course you've heard Zevon, so...
All right, so I have a quick question on the title of that compilation, but before that, I want to mention there was also a greatest hits album that he put out, or his label put out in 86, and I just find this to be a funny title for him. It's called A Quiet Normal Life.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
Yes.
Irony at the height of irony.
That's right. But the I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, that's also... the name of a song on his first album.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. That later became the title of the book mm-hmm. that his ex-wife wrote. But did he coin that phrase, or was that an old phrase, or do you guys have any insight into I'll Sleep
Good
When I'm
question.
Dead?
I don't know. The first I ever heard it was in the Warren Zevon song.
Yeah.
But, it, you know... I don't know.
I don't know
sure
either, but it's great.
Sure.
I mean,
it is. Yeah.
Again, it's a better title than song. I feel like the song's a little annoying. It's just him like bom bom
right.
bom.
Yeah. Yeah. But it sort of it makes sense for that to resurface because it does sort of sum up his life.
No holds barred.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So where are we in the story?
Well, you will recall, gentle listener, that when last we parted, Warren Zevon had released Mutineer on Giant Records in May of 1995. And then he got dropped by his label again. And he wouldn't put out another record for about 5 years. And so during that fallow period is when my full-on Warren Zevon obsession kicked in. As I said, I bought all the albums that were available. Mutineer and Stand in the Fire were not available. I combed books for books about music for Warren Zevon mentions, which, again, some people were on the internet, but I was not on the internet in 1995. So I would go, like, during my lunch break, I would go to Borders and go flip through the sort of music books read, you go to the index, look for Zevon, go read whatever snippet is in there, because there wasn't a lot out there about him.
Right.
So I kept hoping that he would play Philadelphia, but he didn't. So finally, I think because he didn't have a label, so the label wasn't paying for him to go out on the road. He couldn't afford to hire a band. And right. So I think at one point he was booking shows for himself. So he was really, he was not thriving in the mid to late 90s.
Yep.
The one time I saw him live was a solo show. It would have been mid 90s, I think. It was in DeKalb, Illinois, of all places, at just a kind of an average size club, like nothing particularly large. It wasn't a particularly large venue. And he was playing, piano and guitar just solo by himself. But the place was totally packed. I made the mistake of getting there, probably right around set time, and I could not get anywhere near a decent view. So he was beloved, by people, but again, sort of like by people in the know, I think. So,
yeah.
Yeah. And same with me. The one time I was lucky enough to see him was a solo concert, might have been around the same time that you saw him, Hunter. And it was at the Birchmere in Alexandria. And I think all three of us have probably been to that club. But back, they used to have a really, I don't know, call it what you will, policy where they had these little tent cards on all the tables. It's a sit down place. It's one of those, sort of supper club type setups.
But it's like awful dinner theater where you have to go. It's like going to the Benihana of Tokyo where they force you to sit with people you don't know. And you're just like, oh.
That's right. And the food's probably not as good as Benihana, but they used to have these little cards that said, please be silent when the performer is on. We want you to respect the artist. And Zevon spent most of the show making fun of those cards. Like if anybody said anything, but shh, there's an artist here, up here working. So please be quiet, and just totally taking the piss out of that, which was great. But an amazing, amazing show.
Yeah. Yeah. I ended up seeing him probably 5 or 6 times in total, but he the first time I was so excited. It was the fall of 1998, and he plays this place, the TLA, or the Theater of the Living Arts, in Philadelphia on South Street. It's like 4th and South, maybe. And so the TLA is an old movie theater. And so it's got like a sort of sloping floor. It's sort of movie theater sized, but it's got that sloping floor. So if you see a show there, by the end of it, your calves are killing you because something about standing on an angled floor. So
fighting gravity.
He plays... It's not sold out, but there's a good sized crowd. And like you said, the crowd, they're fully into it. And he does half the songs on a Kurzweil electric piano. The other half he's playing acoustic guitar. And it's everything that I dreamed it would be. And his between song banner is, of course, hilarious. And it's, he keeps going, "Welcome to the Theater of the Living Arts."
right. Same kind of deal. Yeah.
And, he kept coming back and he would always play the TLA. Like I said, I probably saw him 5 times but he would come back and it would be pretty much the same size crowd. And he would always be, he would always play Werewolves of London. And that's one of the things I love. I read there's the Crystal Zevon book, and then there are a couple other books about Zevon now, one of which, I forget what it's called. It's a okay, you know, it's a fine book, but like the Crystal Zevon book is so great and it's definitive. This is more sort of like he interviews Jordan Zevon a fair amount, and there's some really interesting stuff in there, but a lot of it's sort of analysis. But anyway, Jordan Zevon's got this great line in there where he says his dad always said, like, whether you're Johnny Rotten or Lawrence Welk, you have the same job. Like, you're an entertainer.
Right,
and
right.
So, you know, he always, a lot of people might have, you know, been bitter and said, I'm not going to play Werewolves of London. That's a silly song. But he knew that people showed up for it, and he always played it. And and he was always sort of a good sport about it. Like, that's one of the things I loved about him. And I think, you know, as we talked about last episode, one of the things that made me feel like we could be great friends in real life was just that he seemed so smart, funny, and engaging when he was performing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
So.
Yeah. Completely present, you know, in every moment, which is a gift. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he anyway, he starts touring again, which is like a dream to me. I can finally go see the person whose music I'm obsessed with. And it's as great as I thought it would be. He so at some point, like, I hear that he's putting out a new record on Artemis Records, which is a label owned by Danny Goldberg, who had managed Nirvana. Mm-hmm. So, but I don't really have high hopes for it because, you know, I'm excited to hear the record, but Mutineer was, you know, it had its flaws. And then the first single from the record, I Was in the House When the House Burned Down, like, it's a good song, but it's not great. So the album, Life Will Kill You, comes out in January of 2000, and it exceeded my wildest expectations. It is right up there with the first album as my favorite Warren Zevon record. And interestingly, it's produced by Sean Slade and Paul Q. Calderi of Fort Apache Studios in Boston, who engineered or produced a ton of really great stuff. Like, sort of most relevant for our purposes are the Lemonheads, Dinosaur Jr., and Morphine. And, you know, what's great is, like, as we talked about, the problem with Mutineer was that it kind of needed an editor.
Yeah.
And these guys totally did that. Like, they got rid of the overblown keyboards. It's really kind of a largely acoustic record, but the songs are just so great. And the only co-writer on this one, which is probably, again, why it's such a great record, is Jorge Calderon. There are no guest stars other than Chuck Prophet of Green on Red, who plays guitar on this next track that we're going to hear, which is one of my favorites, and it's called For My Next Trick, I'll Need a Volunteer.
Well, I can song a woman in two, but you won't want to look in the box when I'm through. I can make a laugh.
That's great. And by the way, before you talk about that song, we should mention Chuck Prophet.
Yes.
He's been on our show.
He has.
Before.
Oh, really?
Friend of Rock in the Suburbs. We interviewed him. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Great guy. Yeah.
Super nice guy.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And Green on Red, excellent band.
Oh, yes, my God.
What a great band.
So, what's cool about that song is it's sort of a lighthearted song, seemingly about a lousy magician. But really, he's probably singing about himself. He's like,
yeah.
So much of this comes from the Crystal Zevon book, which is, again, it's just an amazing book, which we'll talk more about on tomorrow's episode. But, you know, he was a womanizer. He was always in a relationship, but then he'd sort of fall out of love with the woman that he was in the relationship with and be really kind of cold about the way that he treated them and would just sort of move on to the next person.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you really get a sense of that where he's like, you know, I can saw a woman in two, but you won't want to look in the box when I'm through. I can make love disappear. For my next trick, I'll need a volunteer. But it's the lyrics to the middle section that I find sort of the most fascinating, where he says, it's lonely up here when the tricks have been played and the spotlights have faded and the plans that we made have fallen apart. It's lonely as hell and there's no magic spell for a broken heart. Which, you know, the guy's in his 50s. He's not a star. He's touring. He's playing the TLA, again, to small, like really appreciative, but really small crowds.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the song... I don't know. It really, it kind of hits you right in the heart.
Yeah, it definitely, it packs a punch, that song. And,
absolutely.
And it's that whole idea, the idea of the trick too, I think really, that I think says something, right? It's that whole idea of like, you need somebody to go through this kind of absurdity of life with, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Which, that is a prescient comment, Jim, because we are about to, actually, a couple clips from now, we will revisit that idea. But let's go now to the title track, Life Will Kill You.
It's the kingdom of the spiders. It's the empire of the ants. You need a permit to walk around downtown. You need a license to dance. Life will kill you. That's what I said. Life will kill you. And then you'll be dead. Life will find you. Wherever you go. Requiescat in pace. That's all she wrote. From the President of the United States to the lowliest rock and roll star. The doctor is in. And he'll see you now. He don't care who you are. Some get the awful, awful diseases. Some get the knife. Some get the gun. And some get to die in their sleep. At the age of 101. But life will kill you. That's what I said. Life will kill you.
I mean, it's a jaunty song about death.
Yeah.
And what I love is, like, the message is that we're all doomed. But what's weird is that song actually makes me feel better about it.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. I can relate to that. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's got the nice part. I don't think we played it in that clip, but it goes on. And he's got a nice part about the afterlife where he says, you know, maybe that stuff's true. It, you know, doesn't seem like it, but, you know, maybe.
Right.
And then
he's got
the line, some get the awful, awful diseases, which, of course, very, you know, soon thereafter, he got the awful disease.
Right.
And the song also, you know, you could compile a long list of great opening lines to Warren Zevon songs, but you've got an invalid haircut. It's going to be longer.
Yeah, that's pretty much out there. Great on a hat, too. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's hear another one about death. Let's go to Don't Let Us Get Sick.
Don't let us get sick. Don't let us get old. Don't let us get stupid. All right, just make us be brave and make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
sky was on fire when I walked to the mill to take up the slack in the line. I thought of my friends and the troubles they've had to keep me from thinking of mine. Don't let us get sick. Don't let us get old.
Okay.
So, I feel like I shouldn't say anything after that because it's so brilliant. Right. But alas, I can't stop myself.
Yeah.
But that's what you were talking about a few minutes ago, Jim, where you said, like, you know, it helps. You need to have somebody else. And that line he says, you know, right before you cut it, "I'm lucky to be here with someone I like." Well, you know, I think. That's always struck me as really profound because I think that's really kind of the best we can hope for and the best we can do in life.
Well said.
Yeah. What point do you want to talk about sort of like his explorations of mortality and that sort of thing? Because it seems like it's kind of always been a theme with his work, but it becomes more pronounced here, and he doesn't even yet, we don't think, know, right, that the end is coming for him, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I find fascinating is like, you know, I have no idea how long it takes mesothelioma to sort of develop in somebody, but you almost get the sense, I mean, this is a death album. Right. But like, as far as we know, he doesn't even know that he's sick.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you know, I don't know, maybe he sensed it on some sort of subconscious level, or maybe it's just getting older and, you know, that's just sort of what you start to think about. And as you sort of implied, Jim, death was never really far from from his thoughts or subject matter.
Yeah.
Yes, I almost wonder in some way if he just, maybe this was a point in life where he's sort of like, I never thought I'd live this long. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, just because of his lifestyle, right? So.
Yeah. Yeah, and what's interesting is like, as a death album, Life Will Kill You is much better than The Wind, which is, you know, a far more celebrated record. And we'll talk about that, you know, at some length tomorrow. But, you know, the problem with Life Will Kill You is kind of, I mean, it was a minor hit. It made it to number 8 on the Billboard indie chart. And, you know, it was really well reviewed. But, you know, the problem is, of course, that like nobody, as a death record, nobody cared because he wasn't dying yet.
Yeah. Yep.
Right.
Right.
Yep. And a quick aside, this album also had the Steve Winwood cover on it, which got some notice, I think, at the time, didn't it?
What was that doing on there?
Well, I don't know, but what I love about it is that he turns a song that's seemingly like mindless 80s pap about I'm back in the high life and turns it into a really sort of mournful.
I know. I know.
Yeah.
It does have a whole different flavor to it, right?
Yeah.
Totally, man. And I think it's interesting, at least from my perspective, and maybe this is, you know, because I'm particularly wired the way I am, and, you know, everybody's complex and you know, but whenever anything tends to go good for me or I do something right accidentally, I'm always like, okay, what bad's going to happen? You know, if you do something successful, you're like, okay, something really bad's about to happen to me, you know? And I think, you know, thinking about him doing that song and the way he does, it's like, yeah, you know, he sees, you know, potentially a pitfall or you know, a darker edge in a song like that, you know, that may be kind of mindless. At least that's my interpretation of it.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, you know, it's in terms of it's, like I said, it was not a huge hit, but it went to number 8 on the Billboard charts. So, you know, Warren Zevon is effectively back, and he gets to make another record for Artemis. And that record is called My Ride's Here. which comes out on May 7th, 2002. And, you know, now that Zevon's back in vogue, the hangers-on are back, unfortunately, or for better or for worse, here largely for worse. He is the sole writer on only one song. Hunter Thompson and Carl Hiaasen each co-write a song. The Irish poet Paul Muldoon co-wrote two. There is a lot of, you know, for lack of a better word, crap on this record. You know, by my count, there are sort of three legitimately really good songs. There's This Time I Have to Leave, which is written entirely by Dan McFarland, who is a friend of Zevon's. And then there's this one, which we were talking about a couple days ago, the definitive hockey song,
yes.
which he co-wrote with Mitch Albom, who wrote Tuesdays with Maury. And this song is called Hit Somebody.
He was born in Big Beaver by the borderline. He started playing hockey by the time he was nine. His dad took the hose and froze the backyard. Little buddy dreamed he was Rocket Richard. He grew up big and he grew up tough. He saw himself scoring for the Wings or Canucks, but he wasn't that good with a puck. Buddy's real talent was beating people up. His heart wasn't in it, but the crowd ate it up. Through peewees and juniors and midgets and mics, he must have racked up more than 300 fights. Till a scout from the Flames came down from Saskatoon. Said there's always room on our team for a goon. Son, we've always got room for a goon. There were Swedes to the left of him, Russians to the right. A Czech at the blue line looking for a fight. Brains over brawn, that might work for you. What's a Canadian farm boy to do?
Hit somebody!
What else can a farm boy from Canada do?
Hit somebody!
What's a Canadian farm boy to do?
Hit somebody!
What else can a farm boy from
I can't hear that song enough, to be honest with you. It's so endearing, isn't it?
It's really great.
Yeah.
Again, born in Big Beaver by the borderline is a pretty opening line.
And also where he just slips in the last line of that verse, he wasn't that good with the ball.
Right.
That's right. That's right.
But
I should mention also Mitch Albom, is a longtime sports columnist for the Detroit Free Press, so he knows something about hockey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, I mean, you know, as you guys were both saying earlier, like, there aren't many great songs about sports because it's sort of, what do you say about sports? But
right.
he manages to write a song about, you know, a hockey goon, but it's like a really sort of compelling thing about a hockey goon that wishes he was something.
Right.
Else.
Right.
Yeah. I know.
And it's great. I would encourage people to listen to the whole thing because it has a great, you know, ending verse and it's a great story song. You know?
Yeah, it does. And that is, in fact, David Letterman yelling, hit somebody between songs. In fact, I think it's the whole late night band that played on it. And
you
like,
are correct. Yeah, that's right. It's Anton Figg and who is it? Sid McGinnis and Will Lee or whoever those guys are.
Right. Yeah. And then, of course, Paul Schaefer.
I've always found Paul Schaefer's organ playing a little annoying, but it's like this was the organ part he was born to play. Because, like, here, just play hockey organ over this.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely right.
So anyway, Zevon premiered Hit Somebody at the TLA, or, you know, he had played it elsewhere.
Really?
But the first I heard it was before there was a recorded version. He played it at the TLA. And, you know, the crowd was shouting, hit somebody. I mean, the song, like, people loved it. Like, they were cracking up at all the right parts. It's just such a great song that even though nobody had ever heard it before, everybody loved it.
Yeah. Well,
and
in Philadelphia, too, that probably goes over well.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, home of Dave Schultz.
Kidding me? Yeah, exactly.
But the thing is, Hit Somebody came out as a single. It was not attached to this album. So it's like, again, my rides here, there just aren't really very good songs on it. And, you know, thank God they put Hit Somebody on there, because, you know, there would have been only two good songs if they hadn't done that. And, you know, I feel badly on the one hand because I'm being kind of harsh about the record. But again, like, you know, as I think you can tell from the previous 3 days, I love Warren Zevon. I think the dude is a genius. He's one of my favorite musicians of all time. And I just think this record is a profound disappointment. But anyway, there is, in fact, one remaining great song on this record. And so let's hear that one. It's the title track. It's called My Ride's Here.
I was staying in the Marriott with Jesus and John Wayne. I was waiting for a chariot. They were waiting for a train, and the sky was full of carrion. I'll take the mazuma, sent Jesus to Marion. That's a 3:10 to you. My ride's here. My ride's here. I was changeless. We galloped through blue bonnets. I was wrestling with an angel. You were working on a sonnet. You said, I believe the seraphim will gather up my pindo and carry me away, Jim, across the San Jacinto. My ride's here.
Okay.
Shadow.
Yeah. So that's, that is another song about death.
Yeah. Right.
And again, like, that's a co-write with Paul Muldoon, which is, I think, why they're sort of more like literary references. It's sort of, I think, not as affecting or as personal a song about death as the ones on Life Will Kill You, but it's still, I think that is a legitimately great song.
Haven't heard that in a long time, and it really sounded great to me. And I may not have even paid that close attention the first time I heard it, but that really sounded good. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. And it's got this sort of chimey 12-string thing again.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Can never go wrong with a 12-string guitar.
No.
So
if you can keep it in tune.
Yeah. So that's and again, like, the cover photo on this record is like him with mirror shades on looking out of the back of what appears to be a hearse. So again, this sort of preoccupation with death persists, but again, as far as we know it, like, he doesn't know that he's sick. Like, this came out, the record came out 2 months before he was diagnosed.
Amazing.
I know. Yeah. He didn't know, but somehow he knew. It has to be. And it almost feels like at ease with it, too, in some way, right?
Interesting. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. Well, anyone with this degree of highly developed artistic sensibility perhaps was able to tap into the subconscious in ways that he may not have been able to explain. But I think what you said there, Hunter, might be, you know, pretty close to the truth. Maybe he knew, but he somehow didn't know, and yet, you know, had to express that somehow.
Yeah, it's funny. It just sort of came back to me that one of the times I saw him at the TLA, he sort of later in life got really into weightlifting, and he was a huge fan of Vin Diesel. So he was like he was totally jacked. And at one of the shows, he was like, I look good, don't I?
Yeah.
And the audience was like, yeah. And he's like, but not too good. I don't look like I'm doomed, do I? Like some sort of William Holden thing. Right. So again, like, who knows? Maybe, like you said, maybe on a subconscious level, he did know.
Yeah. Yeah, that whole weightlifting thing was weird.
Yeah.
Definitely covered a lot in the book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, I believe we are now officially out of the wilderness years.
Yeah.
It got awfully thick in that forest for a while. I felt like I was droning on forever. And like you couldn't see the forest for the trees, but
I'm glad you left breadcrumbs so we can follow our way out.
But some really good stuff there. Some really good records.
Fantastic. You know. Yeah.
So thank you again, Hunter. This has been illuminating.
Absolutely. This is going to be a very popular series of episodes.
I think so.
I hope so. I hope people aren't like, man, this would be so great if that guy would just shut the hell up and listen to the Lauren Zevon songs.
People have been saying that for 900 episodes about me. And we're going to get shirts that say, am I still talking? I think that was decided last night. Yeah.
If we haven't driven them off by now, I mean, come on.
That's right. They're in. They're in. They're in.
That's right. Who was the dog we heard barking?
That was my dog, Hugo.
Oh, I thought that was Shadow.
Nope.
It was Hugo.
That was Hugo.
Yeah, I think we met Hugo when we were down.
We did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In fact, when you guys spent the night, I think Hugo slept between
you. That's right.
If I'm not mistaken.
That's how that worked.
Thankfully.
Hugo's fluffy, right? What kind of dog is Hugo?
Hugo is a golden doodle.
Yeah. Very cool.
Okay, let's move on to the thrilling conclusion. Tomorrow.
Yep.
Warren Zevon Week on Rockin' the Suburbs. All right. And if anyone has any comments on Warren Zevon, we would love to hear from you. I've kind of been saving that till we got toward the end of the week here. Mm-hmm. But there are ways you can make your own thoughts and feelings known to the vast audience of our show. You can call 612-440-1984. Very good. Or you can email rock@suburbspod.com, or you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those at suburbspod, and make comments there and so on.
Okay. And what do they do if they don't have a phone?
You can just stick your head out the window and yell.
Yeah.
That always works. Somebody will come eventually if you keep yelling.
Yeah. It has to reach Canada, though, for Matt, intern Matt, to hear it.
Yell loud.
And then, and then, you know, catalog
also
that
flaming
for us.
Arrows.
Yeah. And I always love the yelling out the window bit.
Yeah. And then, intern Matt, probably a hockey fan up there in Canada.
Oh, definitely.
He probably understands all the references in that song. So,
yeah, is he up there in Big Beaver?
Near the borderline.
Yeah.
All right. With that, let's get out of here. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And I'm guest of the week, Hunter Bennett.
We'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
I had the ship till it all got smoked. I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the love cup. I stood on the banks till the river rose up. In the house when the house burned down. I may be old and I may be bent, but I had the money till it all got spent. I had the money till they made me pay, and I had the sense to be on my way.
The number is 612-440.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he knows.
Wait. Sorry. Okay, go ahead. I don't know.
1984.
Oh, you know why I totally blanked? Because I was thinking that in the song Carmelita, he says she's there, something about she's in Ensenada, and I'm here in Echo Park. And of course, when you mention that call-in line, one name springs immediately to mind.
That's right.
And I was thinking how great it would be if Echo Park Jimmy were to call and weigh in on Warren Zevon. I'm not positive, but I'm thinking he's probably a fan and probably has many insights that I can't wait to hear.